Hello and welcome to Keyframes in Betweens, a mini podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton. With me today is Andy.
Hey, hey, hey.
Duncan.
Yellow.
And Jeff.
Yellow.
Double yellow.
In honor of the latest adaptation of Inio Asano's work, Dead Dead Demons DDD Destruction, coming out, we've decided to take a look back on his manga releases and the adaptations that have been made from them. This was Andy's topic, so I'll hand it over to him after warning y'all that there is going to be discussion of suicide in this episode. So, take care.
Yeah. So I was trying to think on my drive down to Cambridge over the weekend, what it is that makes Inio Asano's works so enjoyable and relatable. And I actually found it out perfectly described by the mangaka himself in the afterword of Solanin, which I finished yesterday, where he says, "Lovers, friends, money, jobs, a society with an unclear future, one's own pride. Writhing in these multiple entangling factors, perhaps they are unable to draw any conclusions. Perhaps this instant, now, is just a small part of their futile daily lives. The only thing that's certain is that they can never return to the days gone by. There's nothing cool about these characters. They're just your average 20-somethings who blend into the backdrop of the city. But the most important messages in our lives don't come from musicians on stage or stars on television. They come from the average people around you, the ones who are just feet from where you stand. That's what I believe." Inio Asano, 2008. And from 2008 to 2024, I still feel that's kind of like what makes his manga his manga.
That's evergreen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you're talking about a personal story about a girl and her making music because her boyfriend died, or aliens invading the world, the thing that I'm always drawn to in his work are these human relatable moments.
Yeah, he seems to have a really exceptional ability to capture like the deep texture of mundanity, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of anime and a lot of media in general have this kind of romantic era around boredom, that like every day is the same, and we have like Endless Eight, where you're literally just repeating the exact same moments, as kind of a metaphor for tedium and the melancholia for Hisuzumiya. But with this, like with Solanin, with Dead Dead Demons, it's really striking how well he captures that what's boring is you don't know what's important, because mm-hmm. Stuff is happening that will change your life, that will change the direction of where you're going, and you have no way to assess it until it's far, far in the past and has already begun to be like distorted into nostalgic memory. And I love that in Solanin. Throughout the entire time of reading it this weekend, I couldn't tell if I've read it before or if it was just resonating so much with me.
That, yes.
And the art style I'd gotten used to from watching Dead Dead Demons. I'm never going to say the full title again for the rest of this podcast because I'm afraid of not getting the number of D's right. It's 4.
I just called it
I practiced on my walk home. But I just couldn't, because it is this feeling of like, I've got to do something. I've got to do something now. Nothing in my life is happening. I've got to do something now. And like, by virtue of it being a manga, of course stuff is happening. And like, all these people in Solanin and even side characters in Dead Dead Demons, experience extraordinary events, and it's just complete dishwater to them at the moment. And I think Dead Dead Demons does it the best, in that a giant ship appears over Tokyo and you're like, oh my God, this is going to change everything. And it, yes and no. Mm-hmm. And using that as a lens to like how nostalgia is not just poisonous because it makes us live in the past, but because it makes us impose a narrative on things that isn't really how life is lived. It's about how we kind of cheat ourselves by pretending that there is that, like, if you're directionless, you're not going anywhere. Of course you're going somewhere.
And also specifically in the terms of Dedede, like the imminent like threat is something you like, you realize, you accept, and you normalize, and you just forget that it exists, and you just go on living your life. And that is,
how could you not?
Yeah. Like, it's like, how could you not? But then, like, again, like, how could you be paralyzed with these thoughts and with these worries when you still got to do high school? You still got to do your 9 to 5. All of his works, like, accept and understand the mundanity and sort of the paralyzing effect that not that inaction has, but then also the paralyzing dread that action also can come with, you know. So many in Solanin especially, like, she is paralyzed by fear on the idea of like acting on her actual ideals and dreams.
And she's pushing everyone around her to make a decision so that she can react off of that decision. And like, it's so much easier for her to impose on this circle of friends that's like slowly fraying as everyone finally reconciles to their 20s and starts moving on with their life. She's pushing, like, she makes a big change and it doesn't do anything. So she pushes for her boyfriend to make a big change, and she pushes for his friends, their mutual friends, to make a big change. And just like the feeling that she can't do anything to change things, that other people have to, it has to be some sort of movement that she's buying into. And that's, it's not how life works. Everyone's got their own stuff to look after. Like, the alien ship may be above, but everyone's, like you said, got to go to school, got to go to work, got to make rent. You can't, like, expecting someone else to change your life is unreasonable, but it's what we all hope for when we feel trapped like this.
With a lot of authors, the narrative will give us a perspective which we're supposed to, how can I put it? We're supposed to, it takes a stance. It'll say, this is how I feel about this event. This is how you are supposed to feel about this event. Whereas Asano's more, you are here to witness these events. You are not here to understand them. You're just, they are going to happen. They're going to unravel in front of you, and you're going to see how it all plays out. And like, for me, I'm glad you two have both enjoyed Solanin, because I first read that in my when it came out, when I was in my mid-20s after having just quit my job. So that was interesting, and I'm glad without that extremely specific resonance that people are still able to enjoy it.
Well, it's not like, it is a dream I feel that everybody has, that they quit their job and follow their heart as to do something different.
Yeah.
So I feel that resonance is always there. There's always that, even in the job, even when I work, there's always that rebellious side of me who's just like, I could just quit it all and I can just fucking do what I want. I can make a video game. I can make music.
Yeah, he literally talks about in the epilogue, Asano does, about how, like, if you know the right thing to do, you want it, like, a part of you will want to do it wrong on purpose. Now that you know the right way to go about things, the temptation to do wrong is greater, not lesser. Mm. And I think that's kind of like, again, we talk about the paralysis, the like resistance to direction that's going on. And
I also really, in like a separate note, I also really love the way that he says there's nothing cool about these characters. That also really resonated with me throughout all of his works, because like, they're kind of nothing. It's like, no one is a hero. No one is like out to save the world. Everybody is like complicated and messy. And I also like really love the way, on top of that, he draws his characters. Like, he never draws them in a way that is 100% cute, anime, perfect aesthetic. They all have like odd little, like, instead of charm points, like ugly points, you know? Like, you've got Oran's like weird crying eyes, you got like eyes like pig nose, and they all kind of add like this ugliness, which then also I feel reflects so well to humanity more than any other mangaka style does, that makes you just sympathize and enjoy them a hell of a lot more.
I especially with Oran Onten in Dead Demons, where we find out that her like wacky over the topness is not just because she's a manic pixie anime girl. It's that she's forcing herself to be this outsized figure to kind of give her friend Katode a like beacon to focus onto so that she doesn't become Yagami Light from Death Note
again
with all her and you think that like, oh, she's got this like wacky melty face, and that's actually one of the ANN reviews point out that that's like her, the inside, the shy girl that she actually is, like melting down over how like embarrassing she's forced to act to embody this character. So no one's given this like exceptional quality. Like, everyone is very normal. No one is supremely talented. No one is destined for greatness. Everyone's kind of just faking it, and Anten is the biggest example of that, but everyone's kind of just playing along these roles that they don't find fulfilling because they're not true to them, but they don't know who they are true to, etc. And it's really well textured in that way.
I loved the character arc of Anten over Dedede. Like, at first, she, like you said, manic pixie dream girl. And then, like, after you see her backstory and you see Katode being, like, an absolute evil megalomaniac who thinks that she's the only one who can solve the world, then pushing herself. And it humanizes her to the point where, like, before that, I'm just like, she's just so weird and eccentric and odd. And then at the end...
The capitalism rants, yeah.
Yeah, and then at the end when she gets... confessed with by Orba, I'm just like in tears, and I'm like, yes, she's the best. I love her. Like, I'm so happy that something good happens.
We're into Dedede proper now. Have we done an introduction to what the show is?
No, we haven't.
Okay.
We so quickly, Solanin is a manga about a girl and her group of college friends as they try to figure out what to do with their dreams as they grow up.
It's the coming of age story, but instead of like the coming of age, it's the coming of adult story between the university and an office lady, like 9 to 5.
Right. A transition that's not really covered a lot in anime and manga, because it's such a bleak situation in a way.
I feel like any sort of like a lot of like media.
I would summarize Dedede as. A friendship between two girls as an alien invasion that doesn't seem to be going anywhere is happening, and we discover that these girls' relationship is influenced by an alternate reality where the invasion didn't happen, but it turned out much worse for the girls themselves. Them dealing with this not invasion and the world unraveling around them as their friendship appears instead to grow stronger and stronger.
Yep. Also notable that this is Asano's take on cute girls doing cute things, something he explicitly wanted to explore after the bleakness of Oyasumi Punpun, which we will also be talking about later.
The fact that this is the one where he talks about, I just want people to relax and have a bit of escapism. And he chooses a climate change analogy, end of the world.
We think it's a climate change analogy. I think it's a Trump electing a fascist. It's a America electing a fascist.
I mean,
analogy,
why not both,
honestly?
Ben? Why not both,
I mean, it's a COVID analogy. It is the Fukushima like disaster analogy. Yeah. Like, it's basically just, a surprisingly prescient
analogy,
or yes,
yeah,
certain wars where one side doesn't appear to be fighting back at all, and yet the public opinion seems to be skewed.
A sort of like a perfect capture of our current moment of mundanity with just grinding horror happening in the background all the time, everywhere, except for in your immediate vicinity, which for people like us is a luxury that we get to enjoy, and a unique sort of. Sorry, my dog is going bananas in the background.
There is a very specific, like, world event that's happening that is strong parallels and made it very hard for me to watch some of the mid episodes. He's not telling the future. He is just reusing previous live, like, events, like historical events, and they still hit true even to this day. It's the sad reality of history and, like, humans is that. No matter what time this manga, this anime will be like watched, there will always be parallels to be drawn in the current situation of the world.
Having politician like the prime minister and his staff of advisors be one of like the major supporting character groups, and just this useless prime minister who's being told what to say in every mm-hmm. instance. And like that arc ends with a sweet moment where we're like, he tries to stand up, but they just abandon him the moment he's like, hey, this is messed up. People are going to die because of this. And they're like, no, you're doing the right thing. And like, he actually makes a stand. So even like the characters that have power, it's this weird mundanity, and it is the sense of powerlessness and inability to influence events.
Yeah. And they don't even kill him. They just usher him out of the building, and just like, he just is on the, you know, on the street smoking a cigarette as their like sky fortress takes off into space, so that they can continue their like battle with the rest of the world.
I love, and also the way that they're just like, the only reason that you're the prime minister is because you look a bit like Issa Baetan, and that really resonated well with the young voters. It was just like such a perfect encapsulation of like political satire. And I also, on the satire note, which is so thick in Dedede, I really love how the satire stayed away from the main cast and was purely on these insulary characters who eventually do make their own problems. But really, really good.
I mean, there is some subtle satire, at least in the alternate reality, the first reality, where Katode uses her Doraemon items that she got from the alien scout to go on a murder spree of all the evil people she can find, where she's literally going to like attacking people, like scaring or hurting them, and then asking them to tell her who's even worse than them so that she can go attack them. But she assassinates the future prime minister, and she thinks she's making the, like, that's one of the things that really like drove home for me, is because like she's like, oh, this guy's corrupt, I'm making the world a better place by killing him. And we know for a fact he's completely like immaterial. They'll find a different stuffed suit to be the friendly face of their plan. Like, she's accomplishing nothing besides murdering like a lonely sick man who wants to watch anime with her. And it's again part of like the incredible darkness and the hilarity of wanting to do cute girls doing cute things. And you also have a prime minister being ruled by an evil shadow cabinet, building a space fortress with which they'll rule the ruined world below. Just that juxtaposition, I think, in Dead Demons is really good. And it's easy to say that it outshines like the much more subtle juxtapositions of like Solanin, where you have just the mundanity with like the big things like Taneda's death and that sort of thing.
But the one thing I will complain about with the Demons anime is that fucking episode zero, man. I fucking hated that shit. That really...
No, best thing.
Absolutely incorrect. On top of other weird things that happened where they had the wrong subtitle tracks on, but
standard
Crunchyroll so much.
And Netflix stuff, sadly.
Yeah, I used someone re-edited all the subtitles, and even though all those video files were 2 gigs each, which is unpleasant.
Well,
it was worth it to have proper signs and to have actual little translations, like changing Watarase's comment after his first in-home encounter with Katode, where she tries to hook up with him, where he's like, the translation was like, this will complicate things, but he's literally saying, I'll go look up some porn.
Yeah.
It's just like, those are different. That's not translation. That is rewriting the script.
Yeah.
For no reason.
The thing is, Andy, I strongly think that the problem is the version we've seen of the demons, the destruction, is the ONA version, the original net anime, which came out after 2 theatrical versions. So,
yeah.
One thing which this show is about is knowing something is looking up, seeing this threat above you, knowing that one day something's bad's gonna come of it, and that always being there, you always knowing it, but it's not arriving yet. And I think I remember when I was reading this when chapters were still coming out through scancellations, and there was so much people theorizing, oh, so what's going to happen? Is the spaceship really going to crash? Will it just destroy Tokyo? Will it destroy the world? And I'm so, so, so glad that they just nip that all in the bud before we even get going. I just can't stand people speculating what's going to happen, because the worst, it should not be what the people are thinking about. You should not be wondering, how is the world going to end? The world is going to end. It's just how you're going to live through it. That's what this show is about. It's about how they're experiencing it.
But you don't know the world is going... When you read the original manga, and the original manga's, the original manga was designed to be written this way, so therefore it should have been told that way. But that's a different
point. No, absolutely not.
You're experiencing it with the characters and the cast. There is also a chance that nothing comes of that spaceship.
No one thinks that. Everyone knows it's going to fall.
Does everybody think that?
Yes.
Does everybody know it's going to fall?
Yes.
There are some people who don't.
Like climate change, yeah.
You take away the mystery and the thought and the speculation of what's going to happen, and it just is there. You just know it's going to happen, and it completely ruins the mystery and intrigue.
Who knows? Maybe climate change won't cause the seas to rise. Maybe people will find new solutions to stuff. Maybe all these things will do. Or maybe a looming apocalypse is supposed to be unstoppable, is supposed to be unchangeable.
But Duncan, the thing is that we're trying to change and do stuff about the...
We're not. That's the half the bloody tragedy of it. No one is doing fucking anything about it.
But I am hopeful that there are going to be changes.
Yeah, Duncan is going to be the one doing it's 3D printing a gun. Anyways, my personal take on that is that, and I think Asano probably would agree if he was asked off the record, that the post-apocalyptic stuff is the weakest part of the series. And I think he caught himself, because the ship does crash, Tokyo does explode, little light balls that gooify you if you touch them are released over the world. And in the manga, that was three chapters, and then they jump into a new timeline. I think he caught himself oh wait, I'm supposed to do a happy ending this time, and how about we have her dad is alive and he goes back in time, and now there's we're in another parallel world, and now Sobien is a cucumber man instead of a mushroom man, and we get to have a happy world this time.
And they'll invent Doraemon.
And yeah. And the I think starting with episode zero, I think to me makes sense as a marketing ploy, because that was presumably, I haven't seen the movies. I'm guessing the last movie ends with the explosion.
The movie ends where the anime ends. So the episode zero is completely new for the TV series.
Okay.
And they could have put that in where it was meant to have been, which was between episode 16 and 17, chronological, according to the manga, as opposed to having the viewer know that everything for the next 15 to 16 episodes is completely pointless, because you know the world is going to end.
If only there was a character in the show who knew what was going to happen and couldn't do anything about it. That would be real on the nose, wouldn't it?
Duncan, I'm afraid I don't need an episode 00, because I'm watching an anime called Dead Demons DDDD Destruction. I know the fucking ship's going to crash. I understand from the marketing perspective, yeah, that you want to show something that they didn't have as much of in the movie. So you want to show sci-fi. You want to show that they add in other character parts, because there's these amazing parts, like the episode where I goes on a date and then is like, no, I don't really need to date anybody. That is all original. It's not in the movies. And so they want to show that there's other character perspectives going on. They want to hook in from the sci-fi. They want to show that there's more to the story after what you've seen in the movies happens. So I understand why they put it first, but I also personally feel that I would have been more connected to the first arc of the story if I didn't have this in the back of my head trying to figure out okay, where are we in the timeline versus where we are on the timeline there, and where are we, what's going on. I kind of wanted to exist in the headspace of these two girls who have had a ship appear over their heads and decide to ignore it. Because like honestly what both of you say, like, I can't ignore climate change. I will step outside and it will be 80 degrees near the end of October. Like, the spaceship is there and I can't ignore it. And so to kind of have the slice of life be watching these two characters willfully ignore stuff and willfully ignore that they're in an anime called Dead Demons, DDDD Destruction, was kind of what I wanted. And I know it's really easy to say, like, oh, this would have been better if we'd done a little bit of editing with what goes in what order. But that's the situation I couldn't escape. Also, I don't think the dad is a very compelling character, and I think unfortunately manga authors tend to find the characters of manga authors and editors to be more inherently interesting than they are. And I like this, like, burnt out guy who's just kind of like lost track of his daughter during the apocalypse, and the kind of thorny metaphor of him being asleep possessed by someone else for 8 years and having to kind of like realize that he actually has things he cares about once he's been dislocated from the rest of the world.
I just didn't enjoy
hanging out with him that much. Once I knew all the context, I was happy to see him again in episode 17, but I don't know. There's a long history of weird presentational choices in anime, and like the decision of Haruhi to open with the magical adventures of Mikuru-chan, their shitty fan film that you don't know and is full of like winks and nods to all the magical stuff actually happening to Haruhi. Record of Lodoss War's decision to put their most exciting episode first, and then just have four episodes leading up to that, and then skip over what was there, and then. Yeah, I'm fully used to this, and I'm glad it worked for you. I am, because I do think that that's what they wanted. They wanted there to be an added dimension of impendingness and showing what the stakes were, what would happen when the ship fell if everything just continued to go on how it was going on. But it didn't work for me, because I really wanted to connect more with these two girls who are already kind of hard to connect with. When you first meet them, before you really get invested in their stories and their personality. But
you wanted to be the person who's unburdened by the knowledge of what's coming rather than the one who knows she's initiated the apocalypse.
Okay, so back, you know, to the original content warning. In the original timeline, she becomes friends with Karode. They go to the seaside tutoring. They run into the girls who have the close encounter that they meet later on in the series. And they end up rescuing the invader from those people. And then he sort of starts running effectively social experiments on Karode and Oran, giving her his like magical, you know, future tech, and which she then, you know, develops a god complex and, you know, goes on the escalating killing spree that
takes a potato chip and eats it. That sort of thing.
And which, you know, eventually gets her to the point where she has a mental break and ends up killing herself. And Oran then confronts the invader, telling him, like, I want to undo this. And he's like, you know, what you do, you know, there is no actual point in trying to change anything. We know, you know, your experience of reality being this single thing that happens is actually kind of unusual to us. We come here and we get cut off from the source, but you have, you know nothing but that. So for us, jumping to another timeline isn't all that unusual, but, you know, if you want to do that, I'll let you do that. And he takes her to his ship, which has been, you know, repairing itself in that seaside town, and he puts her into the shifting device, which allows her to effectively go into a different timeline, like rooted at a specific moment in time where it branched off, you know, from other timelines, which she then uses to take, you know, to take Karode. And rather than taking her to that seaside town and having all that stuff with the aliens happen, she says, we're going to go watch fireworks with those annoying girls. We're not going to go do that.
Yeah.
And then as a result, the girls, you know, the people who met the alien in that seaside town abuse that alien, and he says, okay, you know, fuck these guys, I'm gonna call in the invasion. And then that's what results in the ship coming in. So she has no idea what the consequences of her actions are.
And also in the the invader researcher in the first timeline, the original timeline, he says, I have called off the invasion. Mm-hmm. They will not be coming because we have told them to go away and the Earth isn't ready yet.
I mean, exactly. But she changes the events which stop an invasion from happening. And so that's going to lead to an invasion happening. But I'm leading us to get trapped in a time loop here, so we should move on.
Yeah, I think the implication for me, at least, was that he gave these simple tools to a child, and she killed like several dozen people with them, and that was enough for them to be like, "Holy shit, humans are crazy! Even a kid is able to do this much murdering. We are not going to colonize this planet." But when it's just him getting bullied by a few kids and he escapes, and like it's this idea that, yeah, like there's bullying and there's bullying, there's violence and then there's violence, and there's like an invasion and then there's an invasion. That's, if that makes any sense.
She has the quotes when she's being silly, like, okay, the thing all the governments and all the world should be really afraid of is me.
Oran, yeah, that's part of her, like, she makes her the villainous demon freak to rob that role from Kadode, who eventually extrapolate that out into a murder spree is Oran's fear. Mm-hmm. I thought,
yeah, she knows there's going to be consequences to changing the timeline, but yeah, she says, I'm one of, you know, my, because her brother Hiroshi tells her at some point, you know, don't worry about the world, you know, if you want a reason to live, choose one person and decide to protect them. And that's what she decides to do. And the rest of the world going to shit is sort of a consequence of that. But she has no idea what the extent of it is going to be.
It's kind of a Fight Club-y sort of relationship in that, like, the bombs go off and the financial district is destroyed. But these two people have found each other at the end of the day.
I genuinely thought there was going to be a Fight Club thing where there is no Tyler Durden or whatever. Because when you meet like Orba, and then Orba and Kadode have that connection, and he's just like, you know, there's two people inside of you. And I'm just like, what? Is one of them not real all this time? No, they are not real.
It's Kadode was like Tyler Durden.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I thought for like a solid like few episodes.
That's not a bad take on it, yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Because that would also explain like Oran as a character being so crazy and like you just can't connect with her.
And the whole Doramen being kind of like an analogy for an imaginary friend as well. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, that's really interesting, but completely didn't go there.
It's not true. It's completely incorrect, but I did think that.
It's fun when to hear a completely different reading, because like, when you've already read like 3/4 of a work, like, and you go into watching it, like, you can't but help have certain things baked into your perception of it. And I know part of the reason I am accepting of this is because I did already know those things, and so I can't but help interpret those things as being that way. Whereas you're coming in fresh, and you can make all these things. Oh, like, oh, maybe Kadode's was never really there. Maybe it's just an analogy for something. But nope,
came in semi fresh. I dropped off to like 2 volumes where there wasn't the announcement that like the world is ending in 30 days.
I know Ben's talked about with Freyan, like, he, like, part of the charm of that is, like, its whole sort of date is, like, X number of years since the death of Himmel the Hero. Like, for me, like, DDD's little framing of X days till the end of the world was mm-hmm. its equivalent. That certainty of the destruction being just, like, hard-coded into the timestamp. This made this inevitability all the more concrete. I wonder when it came into the manga. It had come in by the time I dropped off.
I haven't watched the movie versions of it yet because I don't think I can legally. But I would imagine a good place to put the splash screen 30 days till the end of the world will be the end of the first movie. So that would be like halfway through. And I roughly think it was about halfway through when I watched it that the splash screen of like 30 days till the end of the world happened, which, I mean, ultimately, I guess, doesn't really matter, but it does color your complex, especially also like the Fujin stuff. Like it starts off with like Fujin like Mark 6, and then you end the back of your head, you're like, well, it goes up to Fujin Mark 9, and so you know there's gonna be like four things.
I did like that part of the episode zero foreshadowing. It's just like knowing how high the marks go and to like see how what the technological jump is with each new thing. That was more interesting example.
There's also a slight thing where you, again, I guess you can enjoy the fact that you know that invaders can copy people, so you can also have this other running thing where it's like, is this a real person or is this an invader? Like, only comes up twice, one in Orba, who you know is an invader because she splits his face and it's very creepy how he uses like real pictures, and then the other one is the leader of the SES, who people suspect is a invader, is because he's able to produce F energy and F technology. But I just don't I just don't buy that as a reason as to why he would, unless it just means that he gets more power because he has technology. But then why does he give all the power to the AI, to his like his flame as a secretary lady?
I would say one reading of that could be, Andy, that the invaders don't necessarily seem time linearly, and they basically think they are descendants of the people who come from this world. There's nothing to say they're not humanity's descendants, and it's humanity looping back on itself.
Possible, but then
the other thing is like they don't think of themselves as invaders for that reason. Like to them, they're just coming home, and part of the whole thing going on with them and humanity is that though the individual aliens want to coexist, they have the people back home who have sent them out do not seem to be particularly care for them.
There's there's a moment where they said that the ship was sent as a way of basically dealing with overpopulation.
It's a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy joke where they put all the telephone cleaners and hairdressers in a ark ship and send them off and say, we want you to get our planet ready for colonization later. And then they never send the other two ships.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all die of an unsanitized telephone. There are hints, as Jeff said. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Jeff, but there are hints that it's a eugenic, it's a eugenics effort to like get rid of unwanted population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the one thing I thought was interesting, especially towards the end, as the unmanned like Fujin robots that just have machine guns now and go into the contaminated zones and massacre the invaders, the apocalyptic sort of like the eschatonic worldview that the invaders take on and starts, you know, it, I'm guessing, mirrors somewhat the mentality behind what was happening in Imperial Japan towards the end of the war, where they start talking about, like, you know, we're going to do suicide attacks and this is going to be a way to, like, you know, we're all dead anyway, so we might as well, you know, do it, you know, go out in a way of our own choosing. And like,
I feel that it's not, again, like just Japan, but many other times in history where something is like that, where it's like, yeah, we're,
and they also have guys going home country banzai like when they're announcing the suicide attacks, which so yeah, I think there's like at least an intentional sort of like parallel there, but, and you can also draw that to other places that are being treated horrendously today and the reactions of those people, which we then use as justification to continue what we're doing to them, which is exactly what happens in day to day.
Yeah, because you know, there's a fact that Kenichi, the leader of the Japanese Freedom Force, even after the world has ended, he still is vehemently detests the invaders. To me, that just viewed it as a like when a group of people or like any sort of like anyone is pushed to the point where they see that there is no hope in their survival, but they have to fight back in some way. They will sacrifice themselves for the greater good. And that's what that rung to me as, again, something that happens multiple times in history.
By the time they escalate to that, we know that the saucer has been set to explode. We know that the people in charge of them are manipulating their own people, and that those like Oba, who are trying to find a way to stop the fighting, are seen as hopelessly naive. The fact the finale of it is his hopeless attempt to stop this meltdown, flying into this rapidly collapsing saucer, to just for this small chance that maybe, just maybe, we can do something, and that it both does and does not work. Just to go back to part of this stuff I talked about before, about like us witnessing things rather than being told how to feel about it. Like I think like that's a very smart decision to like.
Mm.
It's commented upon that, this apocalypse was not as wide-ranging as the apocalypse they foretold, as Kenichi had seen in the memories of the invader he'd looked into, that this mm-hmm. he'd looked forward yeah. and he'd seen the world reduced to ashes, and he was going to, his thing was, we're going to rebuild a pure empire on the ashes of the old. And Oba still sees something worth saving in the old and does everything he can to do that.
Well, that's because the world does get saved by Oba in a way, right? Because he blows up the ship earlier than that was expected, so it blew away all the asteroids.
Still, millions of people die and the world is forever changed. Yeah. So it's still a apocalypse. It's just a different degree, and the bravery to make that choice, knowing that you will not be able to prevent this thing, but you can lessen this thing. That's a difficult thing for humans to choose to sacrifice things for. Like so many times, the argument you'll hear about personal responsibility for climate change is like, what difference can I make? It'll still happen. And if you can make even a small difference, maybe some little tipping point isn't reached, and maybe you end up with a livable world rather than a wasteland.
Yeah, it's a good thing to contrast with, yeah, as we've been talking about, terminally online Kenichi. Asano clearly does not have a high opinion of people who spend all their time on message boards reading posts.
Mm-hmm.
Because like his response to his girlfriend's death is not to blame the government that shot down the craft. It's to blame the inhabitants of the craft itself. Because that gives him more secret knowledge. And he's clearly there's a lot of opportunists who see a decaying social order and use it as an attempt to grab more power than to use what power they do have to try to stop the direction of things. Even down to when Japan is shooting down craft and America is sweeping in to steal the wreckage. There's a lot of dog-eat-dog going on here at the higher levels of power, and people who are aspiring to make themselves influential in the new world that's amusing are clearly just as childish and deluded as Katode is in the original timeline when she decides to become a sonic screwdriver vigilante. And once again, Asano shows this keen interest in like how people respond to the lack of a narrative and the lack of direction and the lack of momentum by kind of creating these proleptic narratives that, I mean, by the end, Kenichi says, I only believe in the information that makes me feel good. And mm-hmm. it's wild that based on that statement, we see what he believes, and it's just the bleakest, craziest shit. and not to mention that all the invaders look like children, and he's just like happily murdering defenseless children as they beg. And even like a fucking soldier, I forget what his name is, Ikeda or something.
Mm, yeah.
The soldier, like even a trained soldier's like, these people are screaming in fear and pleading for their lives. Like, I don't think we're doing the right thing versus, you know, Mr. 4chan over here saying, I guess 2chan is Japan. I'm powerful because I can kill these aliens, and this is my power fantasy. Yeah. I'm gonna make it fit as a power fantasy, even though clearly it doesn't, because there's just no other way for him to understand the alien invasion except as a chance at rebirth.
I've seen it commented elsewhere that the appeal of doomerism, which I am somewhat guilty of on occasion, is that a staunch belief that nothing matters and the world is going to end spares you from responsibility of having to deal with anything that is making you uncomfortable now. And Kenichi fantasizes of this better world after the apocalypse, after the uprising, after the revolution. You know, we don't have to deal with any of the complications of the things now. We don't have to confront any, we don't have to try, we don't have to make connections. We just have to escalate and accelerate the end so that we can get the blank slate. And even in, you know, in the apocalypse, when he's trying to build the second like space fortress so he can escalate the war and get to the proper restart that he wants to see, just by happenstance they fail, he never really gets past that. And I think the message of the show is that when they see what has happened as a result of their choices, Ouran isn't the one who chooses to go back. It's Karore's father who regrets, you know, not being there, you know, even before the invasion, where he disappears and is presumed dead. You know, he's the one who goes to the next world. It's not Ouran, who already knows the uselessness of going back and decides, you know, I'm going to live with the consequences. I'm going to, you know, go forward. And, you know, and their story ends in tragedy, like sort of incidentally. It's never
presumed
really
tragedy.
Presumed tragedy. Yeah.
They tell us they died. The bodies they showed did not look like any bodies in particular. And we hear their voices later in the new reality. We can talk about that
a
second.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does present as a tragic note that he's almost kind of abandoning them to this rad but sad fate.
And also the third world, I still can't help but wonder about. Like, that is still not a perfect world. Like, you don't see Makoto and Futaba at all in the third world, which makes sense because they have no need to go to Tokyo now because there's no invasion, or Futaba doesn't feel there's a need to go to Tokyo, which means that Makoto doesn't come out and sort of deal with his gender identity. And so he is then stuck, presumably, can't remember where they're from, but they're from
the Inaga, basically.
Some boonies somewhere.
Yeah. and still stuck in this sort of hellscape of mental anguish, which is his own gender identity crisis that he can't deal with.
To step down from grand stuff, I liked Makoto.
I love
as an anime fan, whenever it's like cute cross-dressing male, I'm always like, uh-oh. But no, he seemed to be a very considered, authentic picture of a not necessarily mainstream gender identity, even mainstream among the, like the various umbrella of trans identities. The stuff about not wanting to swim because he didn't want his wig to get wet or fall off. Like, I liked Makoto a lot, and I liked that he became a freedom fighter after the apocalypse. Like, it didn't stop his fantasy or his identity from being real.
Yeah, I really like even like having two characters come in halfway through is a risky move for any manga, especially when they're so important as those two. But they are really enjoyable characters that you also can't help but relate to. The way that Futaba gets swept up with ship, and the way that Makoto just like is able to live his like happy life as the person he wants to be are just great character designs and great character arcs that you connect to and feel and you can relate to. Yeah, they're really good. And Karore's great.
It's cute girls doing cute things, delivered as promised. Says what it does on the tin.
Yeah, I do feel that the art didn't need to exist.
I get it though. It's a happy ending. I appreciate that there was a happy ending. I wanted to see these girls actually grow up past college, and so getting that opportunity, there's just a lot of like low level fan service in that, watching them become a manga editor and a marketing presenter for a robotics company where they're making cute dogs instead of automated kill machines.
Yep.
And we still get the nod to the other reality with where they were talking before they left about how they're working on improving the aliens' reality jump technology, and then we see that they've managed to drop a copy of Isobeyan into this alternate reality, and they're talking about how like, oh, we can't get too close yet, it'll distort the field. So this idea that even though we've kind of wiped the slate of Ouran and Karore's like inimitable intimate friendship, there's still a connection, both literal and metaphorical, to this new quote-unquote fixed world, where we find out that it's not enough to have a really good best friend. your parents also have to not be pieces of shit too if you want to grow up without trauma.
And did you notice the Solanin reference as well in that?
I hadn't read Solanin at the time, so you'll have to explain it to me.
Well, the Karore, I hadn't read it at all, but the opening chapters of Solanin is Meiko talking to Naoto as Naoto is too tired because of his job, which is exactly what happens with Karore.
Or Watarase.
And Watarase, yeah. Because Watarase is like, I'm too tired, I can't do anything. He's like, you're so useless. Like, that's exactly the same conversation that happens. And I was like, I don't know whether that's just a fun little Solanin reference.
I mean, otherwise it's kind of dark that even when she does have a present father figure in her life, she still ends up falling head over heels for the sketchy teacher who wouldn't mind fucking a student, yeah. if it really came down to it.
Again, I love the bleakness that Oren has, where it's just like, well, now you're not a student anymore. That excitement's gone. You've just got a lech of a boyfriend.
I think Watarase is probably the closest thing in that particular manga to an Asano self-inserts. And Jeff certainly
mangaka.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
No, I don't think so.
No, he's just a dirtbag, which...
Yeah, but like a soft dirtbag.
I would say Asano's at least a little bit of a dirtbag. He is... Better or worse, this is someone who is not averse to sexualization of his characters. And one of the things, Andy, is like, it's interesting that you made that Solanin connection, because I think that Tanada and Watarase could just be a young and old version of each other. And if you think about how Asano has aged during that time, it kind of... Watarase's kind of like the age he was when writing DDD, and Tanada's kind of the age he was when writing Solanin.
I feel that Inio definitely has an interesting worldview that, like, this constant thing that women are complicated is a thing that comes up quite a lot in his work, especially in Pun Pun as well, which I feel is a weird thing that he keeps going back to, as like, men don't understand women. And it's like, I don't know if that's so true, Inio May. I just think maybe you don't understand.
People don't understand people.
Yes, I agree with you there. But the fact that he would base it down to genders as often as he does, and he does do it a lot. He does it in Solanin, he does it in Dedede, and he does it in Pun Pun as well. Like, that line, women are complicated, comes up in those three shows quite predominantly. And that is weird. I feel that there's a difference between that's just like characters making like those saying those things, and that's just his worldview.
I mean, I think it's a common belief by men that women are baffling also. So it's not surprising that it shows up a lot.
And I think there's also a trend to understand women as uncomplicated, as objects, as possessions, and then confronting and then, you know, having to realize that you have to deal with them as people and not just as trophies or measures of your own success.
Yes, that is true. But like, and maybe that's also what he's getting at. Maybe I'm thinking of it too one-sided, and maybe he's also getting at that. Right. Yeah, they are people as well.
You know, the main core cast of Day-Day-Day-Day, the five girls, one of whom is killed somewhat early, none of them really cleave to any particular stereotype. They all have layers. They all have, you know, a gutter mouth and a dirty mind and bad habits and layers upon layers. Like, even, you know, like, I and, like, I mean, Rin, the, you know, like, the tall, quiet girl who gets a job as, you know, at a maid cafe and is always cafe, always you know, sitting very properly and is very quiet. We, you know, one of our first things that we hear about her is that she's like devastatingly into BL and can't form a proper relationship with another guy because she can't help but fantasize about him getting it on with another dude. And like, just, you know, the fact that, like, you know, none of them are just like good, proper people. And then that extends to like Futaba, who want, you know, she's idealistic, but also gets caught up in, you know, like the day-to-day sort of mundanities of her life and being confronted with the, you know, the wild escalations of SHIP, the extremist organization that she gets caught up in, thinking it's just like a civil rights group.
But also targeted, right? She specifically gets targeted, and you can tell that by one of the characters who's just like, yeah, this is the person, because she is... She gets given the gun because she's specifically targeted by other people. She would go through with this.
Yeah, she could be browbeaten into being a patsy or a fall guy for this. So, you know, very kind of like, you know, like Sirhan kind of vibes of like, we just need somebody to go through with this, and this is somebody that we can force into doing it. Good show. Check it out. Thumbs up. Recommended.
It was a very interesting experience for me because about a week before I'd watched I Saw the TV Glow, which has no real relation to this, but it is definitely also a show about like things feeling wrong, feeling dislocated, kind of like one of those shows that gives you contact dysphoria. And then I watched and then I finished Dead Demons DDDD Destruction, and basically like I explained it to friends by being like, you know how you watch a really emotionally difficult show and you're like, well, at least I'm past the suicide arc, and then later you're like, oh no, I was past the first suicide arc. And so also kind of had this heavy burden on my mind because it is definitely both are meditations on the on like the suffocatingness of choice, the idea that freedom is just a word that people use, and as often a prison as a key freeing you from that prison, and feeling like if things go the way they keep going, like we are all so irrevocably fucked. And so for like a week after, I just seemed really down, and it was very funny to be able to tell people like, yeah, I watched this cute show about girls going about their lives during an alien invasion. Like, oh, was it like really violent and like grim and bleak? And I'm like, well, it swings so much between this is so bleak and terrible and this is beautiful and 100% worth it. And I think that's a dynamic that Asano has a really, really strong grip on, that like the terrible stuff is worth it. And the ultimate takeaway of the show, if we strip away the prologue, if we strip away the epilogue, if we strip away the side stories, good as they are, that just like, it is worth it for Auron. Like she went from a reality where she had experienced a personal disaster, but the world was safe, into a reality where the world has experienced a universal disaster, but she and her friend are safe. And that was a fine exchange for her. And I think it's beautiful and it's worth it. Yeah. Even if it is also bleak and terrible.
Yeah. Solon in as well, it very much is something which is cognizant of the idea that every choice involves loss. You just don't know how big a loss until later. And you do not know the consequences of your actions, but you just have to keep making those actions regardless, because not doing something is a choice as well.
Yeah, because I mean, if we're moving on to Solomon, like, which is a smaller work, so a lot back to Solomon, sorry. Or well, just moving away from Derrida, because I feel that we've maybe spoken everything we can about that excellent show, but her inactions and actions all can lead to both happiness and sadness. And she has a moment where she's like, I don't want to talk to him about the future, because if we talk about the future, I worry that's going to be over for us. And this is something that is weighing on her mind. And when she does talk about the future, it is the end, unfortunately, but not in the way that she expected, you know? And it's that... Mm-hmm. That tragedy that like he unfortunately gets into a car crash after saying that he loves her and is like driving home, and then her wrestling with that lack of knowledge of what he was thinking. It's beautiful and heartbreaking, and that's what makes his work so great, and that work so good.
How much of Tanada's death did you think was an accident? How much did you think that was a suicide?
I thought it was an accident. But then I read the afterword. I think it's for the epilogue, where first off, I was surprised that he said that Tanada, he's like, I've never liked him. I got really close to liking him by revisiting him in this epilogue, but I don't think I'll ever warm to this guy. But when he talks specifically, about making bets with the universe to make good things happen. That was my specific fixation through most of my teens and early 20s. Like, if I can step over that crack in the sidewalk before this car passes me, then something good will happen. So this kind of compulsion to take risky behavior on a micro level just to feel like there's something happening and you're controlling the big things going on in your life and it's not just a series of boring ideas. It's one of those times where you read the author's interpretation as opposed to kind of having this conversation. It just completely overwrote it for me, because that is how I would die in a bike accident, is trying to push a light, because if I can get through the light, then my electricity bill this month will be lower. I've literally done that. And so to watch him, on the one hand, he's made this decision to be more transparent, to let his girlfriend into the more private stuff, because that's what's killing their relationship, is they're not like really, they're living together and they've committed to a relationship, and there's even the promise of them having agreed to stay together forever, but they're kind of kept each other at arm's length because they're afraid that the other will find out that they're a failure or that they're a burden. So at the same time that he's made this positive, mature, self-aware decision to commit to his relationship, he's still doing these stupid little games with reality and it gets him killed. Is it an accident? I don't think he planned to die, but he did. And it was because of a choice he made. I don't know. That's what I take away from it.
Yeah, I kind of read it as him just so focused on the future and the happiness that he was going to have that he was just blinded by what surrounded him, just wanted to go back to the person that he loved and didn't pay attention to the red light. Why? What do you think, Duncan?
I love that there is not a conclusive reading on this for me. He's having an internal dialogue. He's talking about, I believe I'll have a better life. Do I? Really? Really? Light. The last thought we know is him asking, like, do I really believe that this is the choice I want to make? I don't know what choice he makes there.
Yeah. Yeah, he closes his eyes to think and opens them once he's
made
it.
And then drives. I don't think he sees the red light. It could be both as well, right? Like, he could have seen that red light and just thought, go.
Okay, well, this character is sitting in with Mako just before their gig, where he's like, I don't know what the hell he was thinking when he did that. He's lost this person who's been his friend for so long, and he's just floored by why. Why has this happened? Why did he take this dumb risk? And he will never understand why Tanada did what he did. And I think it's good that we never will have a definitive answer to that. We can have an interpretation. We can think all this evidence strongly backs our interpretation of that, but we will never know for certain. And that's the way it is with every person in our lives. We may think that actions happen for specific reasons, but you never fully know another person's mind.
Yeah, agreed. And that's like a lot of what Mako goes through as well. Like, she listens to Solonin first time, thinks it's a breakup song.
Yeah.
Listens to it later, thinks it's a love song. Goes, and again, like, so many other things that she hears from, like, Tanada's dad, you know, says, like, oh, maybe there was a different, like, there was something that worth staying for in Tokyo. That changes her opinion too. And yeah, it's just, again, this is what Inio is so fucking good at, is making characters deep and complex and interesting, and not, you just can't take everything on face value.
And then the other thing is that then she makes it into her goodbye to him, and their goodbye. Yeah. It becomes a collective goodbye to him, and like, that's sort of recontextualization is very interesting as well.
And also that recontextualization, like, Kato is another great example where the first chapter you see him and his like life, you see him like trying to chat up Ayukawa, this other younger freshman girl in the college that he's at, and then only to find out at the very end that he's already got a girlfriend that he's madly in love with and has been like going out for 6 years, and he just decides that never to say that. She's like, and then you think that's a weird douchebag move, but also that guy's complicated, and then you see that their love is strong, you know. Great, really good. I feel we also haven't spoken about Shabbat Pun Pun, which is his big, big work, which I feel that only me and Jeff really have any.
Yeah, I couldn't find the time. Matter. I was hopeful, but.
I read a chapter, but again, like, I feel that there's, from the part that I read, it was like the opening parts of Solanin, in that you just get the idea of Pun Pun being an incredibly complex, like, completely relatable character in some aspects, completely alien in other aspects, and like he has his, as you go through his like childhood, and yeah, it's good. It has also the other thing that we haven't spoken about with this Inio, is with his art style. He has a lot of mixed media, more in Pun Pun than Dedede or Solanin. Like, he has a god character who is just a picture of a smiling guy with glasses who comes up in loads of weird places, and there are dream sequences with like clearly copied pictures which do not match his style, as they like follow Pun Pun through like the earth and his mind and what he's getting at. And we know this a bit with demons, like we've seen the ship parts of all 3D drawing, 3D scans of like real life items blown up, and then he just draws all over them to make them look more alien like.
I think his backgrounds are foundational to his sense of style, like that he creates a very specific sense of place by having these incredibly detailed backgrounds. But the sacrifice he has made to do that is those backgrounds are essentially traced over photographs. Or in the case of the robots in DDD, traced over 3D models. And with the spaceships, and he basically had a 3D model with the textures pre-applied, which his assistants then made into a more realistic, quote unquote, and more something which felt as one with the environment. And equally, his choice to do the time travel sequences with sort of broken up and sliced up images, that's also something he feels he wouldn't have been able to do without 3D technology. And so, yeah, the mixed media stuff, like the fact that he, for his backgrounds a lot of the time, is drawing over photographs, means like taking a photograph of a person and drawing over it seems a very natural step for him. And I was wondering, Jeff, I'd always, when I'd seen those pictures of that image, I had always assumed that picture was his editor.
I'm not sure who that is. It could very well be his editor. That would be a pretty good joke for a manga god to play.
Because when I first saw it, I didn't know what he looked like, and then I saw it later, and it was, oh, it's not him. So could it be his editor? And that just because, like, the whole to an author, your editor is God thing, it seemed like the sort of joke he would go for.
And it's also incredibly mean to him, and constantly telling him just to die, shit or get off the pot, or just kill yourself.
Yeah, like, but also in Pun Pun especially has loads of, like, you say traced over backgrounds. Pun Pun specifically just doesn't have traced over backgrounds a lot of the time. A lot of like the main art and a lot of like side art, as well as like, well, as panel art, are just photos with Pun Pun drawn in. Probably because Pun Pun is such an easy to draw character, which is just like, and also like a weird thing with Pun Pun, and especially you get that a little bit with Oran in Dedede. Like, he's drawn so different. He's like this, you will know Pun Pun when you've like come up on the internet, because he's just like a white bird character, like super simplistic drawn, like no body structure, just a white sheet basically with a nose.
A quick intro for Oyosumi Pun Pun, aka Goodnight Pun Pun. It is Asano's explicitly like anti-romantic comedy romance manga about two children who fall in love and grow up together and then go on a road trip and have a happy ending, only none of those things happen in a good way.
I haven't finished it, so yeah, I don't know what happens.
It closely follows the life of Pun Pun from his early childhood to his late teens, early 20s, I believe. And uses a very Stark style for the character himself, who, as you said, presents as this sort of simplistic doodle, as do his parents and immediate family. But he lives in a world of, you know, more realistically drawn, if slightly bizarre, side characters, and deals with him sort of living in this self-imposed isolation and misery that he is simply incapable of escaping from, partly because of his own personality, partly because of trauma that he's experienced growing up, partly because of, you know, who his parents are, who the, you know, what the world around him is like. And it's this interesting story about a basically, like, you know, like a fucked up guy trying to do the right thing and just failing constantly and being disgusted by himself, and, you know, sort of, you know, somewhat improbably the world around him trying to draw him out, you know, usually for their, you know, for their own purposes, but also just these portraits of desperate people looking for connections, looking for you know, looking for help and looking for love. And it's in and has one of the bleakest endings of any manga. Like, there's a particular image that I don't know if I want to go into it too closely, but there's like something that's like hasn't hit me like that hard in any medium ever, especially having, like, you know, I first read Pun Pun more or less over the course of a weekend, and so I had this very intense sort of familiarity with all the characters and watching them grow up and change, and then one of them just ending all of a sudden. That moment was just devastating in a way that has not been matched in anything else. And Day being a sort of, like, you know, intentionally less heavy topic, you know, it sounds like a joke to say, like, oh yeah, Day is, like, you know, his vacation from doing serious works. And but it, going from one to the other, you can kind of see what he's talking about. You know, he is somewhat incapable of just doing a nice feel good manga. Like, his in interviews he has said explicitly, like, I'm trying to get better at this, but when I was writing Pun Pun, you know, he said he felt like he had an antagonistic relationship with the reader, and every time something bad happened and his readership dropped, he was like, oh, you think that's bad? How about you see that? How about this? And he's like, at this point I lost half my readership, and then at this point I lost half my readership again, and that was just kind of like, but I took that as a badge of honor. And he wanted to get away from that in Day, but I think his commitment to staying with this, like, deeply disturbed character who is navigating his own disturbedness in a way that, you know, from the outside is obviously horrific and wrong, but at the same time he's able to convey how Pun Pun is in a spot that is inescapable. He is incapable of seeing himself from the outside. The fact that he looks the way he looks, I think, is sort of a reference to that he doesn't really understand himself, and so his self-image is this weird squiggle character that is not applied to the world around him. And similarly, nobody else looking at him has an understanding of who he is. Like, it's primarily a projection
that's
of his
interesting, own. Because I do wonder, like, how they view, everybody else views Pun Pun.
There's a brief moment, because, like, Aiko, his, like, you know,
is like forever love.
Yeah,
basically.
She sees him as an escape from her life. Sachan, the, you know, the aspiring mangaka, who latches onto him because she thinks he's got an interesting story that she can mine, but also because she wants to save him because she sees herself in him, says that, like, you know, she tries to draw pictures of him and she's like, I can't even really picture his face. He's just so normal and so ordinary because he's empty inside, so he doesn't have a personality projecting out beyond his, like, his bleak shut down nature. And
which,
so,
is, yeah,
yeah,
And also, I like the way you described like the weird characters, because again, I think that's such a traditional, trope where he does not draw characters normally in cute. He always adds a little weird sort of ugly point to them, which makes them so much more stand outable and relatable and can identify with that character a lot better. And you identify the character as well, as opposed to a sea of generic anime faces where I'm just like, which character are you again?
I spoke about this before, but it's a well-known psychological thing that the more abstract you make a character, the more relatable it is. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Asano. He's good at doing mangas. You should read them.
The one thing I would say is, I think as just kind of highlighted with Pun Pun, that the two main works we talked about, His Solanin and DDD, are probably the most easily palatable of his works. I would say Nijihara Holograph and is more in the same level of pain and violence and psychological trauma of something like Pun Pun than Solanin or DDD, and I would be far less inclined to recommend it to someone. This is very much an author who you do not say, oh yeah, just read any of his works. It's very much that there are entry points to this canon, and you should acclimatize yourself to whether you really want to deal with some of the shit he's going to throw at you, because he is actively antagonistic towards his readers with the violence and the boundaries self-harm. He pushes. Without going into detail about it, I think in if you wanted to draw certain lines, you could call a girl on the shore pedophilic. Like, it's extremely disturbing work, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone who doesn't consciously make a choice to go and read that, knowing that this is the sort of thing that Asano has decided to explore in this work. And
you didn't even want to recommend Solanin to us.
Yeah, well, it's like
on chat, like, you were like, I wouldn't recommend this manga to anyone. It's just I would recommend this. It's good.
It's because part of it is because I interpret it as having something which could be seen as a suicide in it, and I'm very hesitant to ever recommend a work which has something which can be so triggering for someone as that. It's I think there is a step between works like Solanin and some of his others. So yeah, do not dive in randomly here.
And I will say Asano is also on the record saying that he doesn't see a point in seinen manga if it's not upsetting in some way. It is explicitly for adults. It's not something that you can just give to, you know, a random teenager and say, oh, you can check this out. This is a fun, happy romp.
Yeah, like adult themes are kind of overused as a terminology, but I do think that a lot, like a random teenager would not necessarily engage with a lot of this content. So much of it is about just like how life starts to blur in your memories when you've lived it for so long. Even though it is also about like the excitement and joy of like childhood dreams and the potential laying out in front of you. So yeah, make sure to curate what you read of his if you are reading it. All right. Well, let's call it there. Tune in next month. We will be talking about our top 5 anime of the year and just what we've been watching that's not the airing series. Remember, rate, review, and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Find us on Facebook, search for Keyframes Podcasts. Find us on Twitter at Keyframes Pod. Email us questions, keyframespodcasts@gmail.com. We read every single email and respond to the ones that require a response. And most of all, tell a friend.
But not just any friend, Ben. I'd tell the friend who recently told you that you're easy to please, and then work out whether that's a good or bad thing, because I'm still not quite sure.
tell your friend who has dealt with parental abandonment by convincing herself that she's more mature for her age and has a superior sense of morality that might go wrong sometime in the future.
Tell your friend who desperately needs to piss so wants to end this right now.
Say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye. Bye. Bye.